this week on Art on the Air features book and papermaking artist Don Whitmer, whose work features structures that explore movement and light. Next, jewelry artist Amy Butts, who uses found objects and crystals that inspires her special creations. Our spotlight is on the Everly Set, appearing January 30th in Munster for the Lakeshore Concerts.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM and WVLP, 103.1 FM, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming at WVLP.org, and every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Information about Art on the Air is available on our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our shows are available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for more information about upcoming shows and interviews. Like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight. They'll be performing at the Munster Auditorium for Lakeshore Concerts on Monday, January 30th, 2023. That's coming up very, very soon. They're called the Everly Set, and obviously it's a great takeoff on the Everly Brothers. Jack Sculler and Sean Altman, welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Well, it sounds exciting, but we kind of want to hear a little bit about you, so we'll explore you, and then we'll talk more about the show itself. So, Jack, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, first I'd like to say thanks for having us on. We're psyched to come to Munster, Indiana. And, you know, we love our show. It's a lot of fun, and it's timeless music that, seems to be appreciated by all ages. And, we love keeping the Everly Brothers music alive. And we came to this music, through our friendship, and we had been, singing together for a number of years and started this show out of pure fun and kept it going just because we loved it so much. So
did you have a band when you were in high school or grade school?
I started my professional career when I was 14, and that's around the same time I met Sean, and I had a record deal. We were both, approached this world from being songwriters, which I think gives us kind of a unique perspective. And, I've been singing my whole life, and we both have many other projects, but this is something that keeps giving and giving for us.
Excellent.
Jack is being shy about the fact that he was a Disney recording artist.
That's the soundbite I forgot to mention.
It's hard for, you know, on stage neither of us toots our own horn. We toot each other's horns. He says all the...
It's a good friendship.
He lists all my accolades and I list all of his. Did you know that Jack was featured in 17 Magazine in their Hot Guy panel?
Wow.
That's right.
So
we have dating advice to lovelorn teenagers. That's right.
Hot Guy on Art in the Air Spotlight. So, Sean, let's tell us a little bit about you. And just before we got on the broadcast, I said my daughter, who's now grown up, is very familiar with something you wrote. And then you also established another thing called the Rockapella. So tell us about your musical history.
Well, most importantly, I was featured in AARP Magazine's Hot Guy panel. Put that out there. Giving dating advice to lovelorn
seniors.
Geriatrics. I was one of the founders of Rockapella. 5 years into our existence, we got cast as the house vocal group on the television show Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego, and I wrote that song. And that song, it didn't pay for a new kitchen, but it paid for like new knobs on the cabinets.
Right.
And it served me well. Oh, and by the way, that song was just named number 81 in the top 100 TV theme songs of all time by Rolling Stone magazine. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
There you go. Well, wow.
And it is a very catchy song, too. I mean, I as soon as I see that, all of a sudden it plays in my head.
But never as catchy as Bye Bye Love, Wake Up Little Susie, Kathy's Clown, or All I Have to Do is Dream. That will haunt me forever.
Well, and that's a great segue. So tell us about the show with the Everly set.
So as Jack said, we met on stage when he was 14 and I was decidedly middle-aged, and we were paired together to sing one Simon and Garfunkel song at a Simon and Garfunkel tribute night in New York. And we harmonized really well, and we would see each other backstage occasionally, and we always gravitated toward Bye Bye Love and Wake Up Little Susie because those were two-part harmony songs that we both knew. And after seeing each other backstage at various shows, we started guesting at each other's shows. And then we did a couple of, you know, very casual, like, you know, garden party performances together. And when he was 18, we started talking more seriously, but never really seriously, about, hey, you know, we sound so good together. Maybe we should actually do something. But when he was 18, we said, all right, we're going to put together a 45-minute set of Everly Brothers music and play it at a small club. But it took so much work, not for him because he's a very good guitar player, but it took so much work for me to learn that 45 minutes of Everly Brothers music with him that I was determined that the act was not going to die after one performance. So I pitched it to some house concert people that I knew in the folk community, and we immediately got booked. And we started going over really well. And it really just blossomed from there. We never knew that there was a national market for this. But we made a promo video and we signed with an agent. And we've been touring almost constantly for the last 5.5 years or so.
Excellent. So we have just about a minute and a half left, believe it or not, in this very short interview. But you also do another combination of a famous duo. Tell us quickly about that.
Yeah, we have another show, Forever Simon and Garfunkel, and we started it due to popular demand. And a lot of people who saw our Everly Brothers show would ask us to do a Simon and Garfunkel show, so we delivered. We're already touring it around the country. It's an equal amount of fun, and just another decade into the future past the Everlys, and we'd love to bring that to Munster sometime.
Yeah, Simon and Garfunkel and the Everlys are forever linked, because the Simon and Garfunkel started out essentially trying to be the Everly Brothers.
Okay, very good. Well, tell us quickly, we're just about ready to wrap up. Where are you going to be performing, when and everything, so they can come see you?
We'll be at the Munster Auditorium with Lakeshore Concerts, and we're very excited to bring our show to you.
And that'll be Monday, January 30th at 7 p.m. there. We appreciate you coming on Art on the Air Spotlight. The Everly Set, Jack Schiller, Sean Altman. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Bye. Yeah, thank you very much. Wake up little Susie and weep. The movie's over, it's 4 o'clock and we're in trouble deep. Wake up little Susie, wake up little Susie. Well, what are we gonna tell your mama? What are we gonna tell your pop?
Art on the Air Spotlight and the full one-hour Art on the Air program on Lakeshore Public Radio is brought to you by Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker. And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Don Widmer to Art on the Air. Don is an award-winning book and paper artist whose work incorporates hand printmaking, bookbinding, and printing to create works inspired by storytelling, both real and imagined histories. His sculptural artist books include his own writing and combines unusual book structures featuring movement and light. Don creates images within sheets of handmade paper using numerous layers of stenciled plant pulp. He focuses on bird and architectural imagery. Thank you, Don, for joining Larry and I on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome. Hello.
Thank you very much. Hello.
Well, Don, we have a pleasure having you on the show. What we'd like to know is a little bit about you and your origin story and where you grew up and how you developed. Like I like to say, how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us about yourself.
Sure. So I grew up in the Cleveland, Ohio area, and I had always taken art classes and been interested in art, but that wasn't what I pursued initially. I pursued music, and I got a music degree, and for many years I was a music librarian. So I worked in libraries for about 13 years and was around music and performing a little bit. I play piano. So towards the end of that career, I had started taking some community workshops I had moved to Chicago by that time. And I had started taking some community classes at the Columbia College Center for Book and Paper. And I just fell in love with those types of processes. I'm talking about printing and bookbinding and papermaking. So I said goodbye to my library career, and I enrolled full-time in the MFA program at Columbia in Book and Paper Arts. And since then, I've been a full-time artist.
So what did you gravitate toward in elementary school and up through high school? What art mediums did you enjoy then?
It was a variety of things. I think mostly I did drawing. So my high school, Normandy High School in Parma, Ohio, had a vocational art program. So I was able to do art 3 hours a day. I wasn't sure at that time if I would pursue it. But most of what I was doing was pencil drawing or pen and ink. And that has always stayed with me. When I started at Columbia, I was mostly doing print processes. So this is, I'm talking about relief printing, like letterpress or block printing. And a lot of my papermaking now, the imagery that I do, I think my aesthetic is inspired by that line drawing that I had always done, and that sense of thinking about layering of images that happens in printing. I bring that to my papermaking as well.
I know the way you describe it too. It is they're all interchangeable, but you can just see how that has informed your work. I mean, and the detail you get with the plant pulp is amazing, but we should probably go back to the, for our audience, about making paper, because I think everybody's familiar with the paper that we use just generally and that process, but not very many people are familiar with using plants to make the pulp to make paper. So maybe you can take us through your process.
Sure. So I can either start with sort of pre-prepared material, which I get from papermaking suppliers, and this would be sheets of cotton that's already pre-cooked and dried. And I can start with that and reconstitute it to create the pulp that I use to make my paper. But more and more often recently, I'm starting with the plant itself. And you can make paper from any plants, anything that has a cellulose structure, but it's a lot of experimentation with different plants. So I will use local plants like hosta or daylily or iris, and I will cook that material down with what's called a mordant. I use soda ash, and this removes the acidity from the fiber and helps break it down a little bit. So by the time I rinse the fiber, it's soft enough for me to beat that material into a pulp, which I use to make my paper. And that process of cooking with the soda ash results in what would be an archival sheet, so there's no acidity in it. And I'm testing it sort of like a little bit like being in a science lab or a chemistry lab. I can test that fiber with a pH strip to make sure that it's at a neutral point and it's not going to decay or become brittle over time.
Well, I have a tiny world sort of question. My good friend is Andrea Peterson. Do you know Andrea Peterson?
Yes. Yes.
I think everybody in the world knows Andrea Peterson. So I've been in her studio quite a bit. And so I'm sure you're familiar. So I'm familiar with the pulp painting because she does that as well. So what informs your plant decisions? Like, do you have your idea in mind of what you want to do? And then you know which plant then would be the best carrier for those ideas?
Sometimes. And I think that happens more and more. When I started out, it was a lot of just experimenting to see what kind of paper I got from the different plants. And so I was just working with whatever pulp I had available at a particular time to create my imagery of the birds or the architecture. I would just use whatever pulp material I had. But sometimes I am looking for a specific type of plant or texture that I have in mind for a particular piece. For example, if I want to put a watermark into a piece of paper, and this would be a mark in the paper where light can come through, where the paper is thinner at that point. I know that cotton will give me the best results and for that type of a mark. Andrea Peterson actually suggested to me, I have a series of pulp paintings with imagery of steel yards, mm-hmm. and with a lot of steam and the structures of the pipes of the steel yards. And she suggested that I use corn as a Midwest plant related to the Rust Belt and the whole steel industry. And I hadn't thought of that, but she gave me a whole bunch of corn from her farm,
yeah.
which I used for the first time and really enjoyed the results from that.
I know she's also taken farmers' jeans and t-shirts and created that beautiful blue paper, but it's so very local to use local materials. And your work, as all work evolves, you have gotten quite detailed with this pulp. And so I would love for you to explain also about your stenciling in all the layers and how many layers, like what is your most extreme amount of layers and how does that relate to the thickness of the paper? Like how thin are you going with these layers?
Sure.
So fascinating.
So when I was at Columbia and I was at that point studying with Melissa Potter, was my paper making instructor, and she's still teaching there. That's where I learned the technique of using stencils to create my imagery in the paper. And my first images were relatively simple. And for some reason, I think, again, it's this, my background with printing, I was really attracted to that layering and stenciling. So my process has gotten more and more detailed and elaborate over the years. And really, I think it shows up in the architectural pieces. So I can create as many stenciled layers, between 20 and 30 layers sometimes. But to be honest, the paper doesn't get any thicker. The pulp is so finely beaten that the layers, when I'm working, you could see some degree of thickness difference between the layers and where I don't have the extra pulp. But once the sheet is pressed and dried, there's no difference in the layers. It's completely flat and smooth. And I don't think it adds any, if it adds any thickness, it's not really noticeable to the viewer.
So how much patience do you need then to dry between the layers? I mean, you can't really Is this something that can be rushed? Like, oh, I just got to get this next layer on? Or do they all have to be dry before you put the next one on?
No, you can go layer to layer immediately. And sometimes I have rushed through the process. I tend to get better results if I take my time. I can let the paper go overnight if I keep it wet, and I'll just put a wet felt over the top of it and work the next day if it's a complex piece. But I find that the more time I take with applying each layer, and I'm working like within a stenciled area, it's not a single shade of color. Like if I'm working with different shades of brown within that space of a single stencil, I could work the pulp around. I could make it a little bit darker, put some shading within that particular stenciled layer. And sometimes I'm manipulating with a tweezers or blowing on the pulp, and I'm just getting texture within each stenciled layer. So the more time I spend with that, the better results I get, I think, for myself.
So do you think that that's the most temperamental part of the process?
It is, for sure. Yes.
You know, I was looking at the Farnsworth House, number 9, and comparing it to one in My Journey into Color. What's your decision process? It's basically the same image of the same Farnsworth House pulp painting, but one is like nicely colored and the other was just like almost a black and white image on a very subdued background.
Sure. So my architectural pieces started off being different shades of black and white or grays. And I felt most comfortable working in that color palette, again, from probably my drawing background with pencil. But the birds have really helped me to explore color more. And so when I'm recreating an image, I have my stencils already, so I'm able to create an image more than once. And really, I view my process as an experiment in using multiples. So I create at least two of every image that I've ever made, sometimes many more than that. And each time I do it, even if I try to use the same color palette and the same pulp, the image is going to be different just because of that. It's the temperament of the pulp itself and the way that I'm spraying it on or doing my layers. But oftentimes now I'll use different plants when I recreate an image and I'll get a different texture or a completely different color palette. I know with the house that you're talking about, the Farnsworth House, I was most happy with the more neutral color tones I got in that because it seemed more natural to me and more in keeping with the aesthetic of that house.
And I noticed like in your pulp painting for the birds, they are generally fairly colorful with maybe a few exceptions. Detailed, like I'm looking at the cardinals, the male and female cardinal, and you have a parrot there that's just beautiful in the way it's done.
Yeah, thanks. And as I said, the birds have helped me do that exploration of color. Most of the birds that I do have been suggestions from people that I meet at art fairs. My customers or collectors have given me lots of suggestions on which birds they want to see. And I think for myself personally, I'm most attracted to doing the architectural imagery, but I think that the birds have really helped me expand my art. And so I learned a lot from having done those animals.
Now you see also do what you label as books, and they're not really traditional books. They're like a storytelling thing. So describe for our audience about the whole physical book structures that you have. I mean, they're very creative and everything. And like I said, I would encourage people to go to your website to actually view them, but maybe describe that for our audience.
Sure. So I create artist books, and artist books are books that are conceived as a conceptual whole. So the structure of the book itself is part of the whole vision of the book. So it's not just the text within the book, but it's the the casing or the structure that holds the pages. So a lot of my books are sculptural in nature, and I think about the structure at the same time I'm thinking about what will be the contents of the book. So a lot of these, they would be similar perhaps to a pop-up book. So a lot of them would have movement when you open the book, and light would come through, or sound even, as you're opening the book, if you're interested in having a sound element, as sheets of paper move back and forth and hit each other in the way that you construct the book. You can make that happen as well.
I want to go back to your music. Does your music influence, I mean, your music background, I should say, influence any of your, you know, visual art and papermaking and that type of art?
And then how did you pick the gamelan? That was like, I wanted to ask about the gamelan because that's a very unique choice.
Yeah, so my music does not find its way into my paper intentionally as much as I would like it to. Sometimes with the imagery it does. So I have a series of organ pipes, or I had a piece recently that inspired by the artwork of Hildegard von Bingen, who is a medieval composer. But I would say the closest that music has entered into my work has been with the books, books that I know I wanted to create some sound element. And it's the choice of paper. So you get a sort of a rustling tone with flax. Flax is a paper that sort of has a percussive sound to it when it's shaken. It could have that tone. So I've explored it in that way. But I would like to eventually think about incorporating sound a little bit more into my books, but I haven't done that yet. And as far as gamelan, when I studied music, I was in a gamelan ensemble. This is an Indonesian music ensemble of mostly percussive instruments. Just recently, I would say about 7 months ago, I discovered that there is actually a Javanese gamelan ensemble right directly across the street from me. I literally walk across the street to rehearsals. When I found that out, I had to join it.
Oh, excellent. So, John, what do you find is the most limiting aspect of working with this medium, and then how do you adjust for that?
One of the things I think is that the pulp doesn't like to be controlled, so it's always sort of a struggle with the pulp to get it to do what I want it to do. And that's definitely a limitation for my own personal aesthetic. It's helped me to loosen up just the way I think about imagery a little bit, but I think that's a limit. I can't get the type of detail I can with a drawing, for instance. And
yeah, but it seems like you've really solved some of that, like with incorporating just fibers, using the tweezer and just placing fibers to get some of that detail, which is, it's so beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that I have been able to get a certain level of detail that I'm going for. But I think I'm almost reaching a point where I want to start exploring possibly a more looser form of imagery, because I've almost gotten to the extent where this is as much detail as I want to put into my paper. So, you know, we'll see where that takes me. But I would be interested in maybe exploring a more loose form of creating my imagery, possibly in the future.
What do you mean by that? I mean, so is that your next challenge then?
And it could be. The more I meet other paper makers and people that work in pulp, like Andrea Peterson and others, I see everyone has a completely different style, which is amazing and really exciting. And I'm inspired. We probably inspire each other, but I might want to collaborate or work alongside another paper maker whose work that inspires me or I think is really interesting, and maybe learn different techniques of working with the pulp. And this could be a path that I take in the next couple years. I'm thinking out loud here, but there's a particular person up in Wisconsin named Meg Black, and she works with the pulp in a completely different way than me. And she works with really overbeaten abaca, and she can create three-dimensional texture in her pieces. They almost look like impressionist landscapes.
Mm. Yeah, I like abaca a lot. It can do so much, and that translucency is just so beautiful.
It is. It really is.
Don, do you have any exhibits that are forthcoming or other types of exhibitions that are coming up in 2023?
Well, my next one is in South Bend. It's an art fair. I'll just be showing with about 50 other artists. It's called For the Love of Art. And it's at Century Center in South Bend. That's March 4th and 5th. That's my next art fair. I'll have my schedule for the upcoming year posted on my website, which is dwidmer.com. And other than that, I'm doing a collaboration with a series of music events. So they pair, this is called Rendezvous Arts, and they pair an artist with a musical ensemble. So I've been paired with a Baroque music ensemble, and that's something that I'm looking forward to. So that's a series of three concert events. So that'll be coming up in May.
What will that include? I mean, what is your involvement?
I'm able to show my artwork and talk about it before the concert event happens. And my art might be on stage with the performers or in the lobby. And, we'll try to create work that's somewhat has a musical theme to it.
Oh, how interesting.
Well, you know, we appreciate you coming on Art of the Year. We also are familiar with Sheree Johnson and her For the Love of Art Fair in South Bend. Have had her on the show. We appreciate that. That's Don Widmer. He is a paper and book artist. You can find him at dwidmer.com, also on Facebook and other social media. Thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's really interesting. Thank you.
And as a reminder, if you'd like to have your event on Art on the Air Spotlight or have a longer feature interview, email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com.
This is Karen Maria of It's Just Serendipity and an arts advocate, and you are listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
I'd like to welcome Amy Butts to Art on the Air. Amy is a Chicago-based metalsmith and jewelry artist. Much of her work uses found objects repurposed into original jewelry. She calls them wearable nostalgia. Amy finds inspiration in the ways jewelry can spark memory and play the role of souvenir. Thank you, Amy, for joining Larry and I on Art on the Air. Aloha and welcome.
Thank you.
It's nice to meet you.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to share my work and my history and my story with you about how I became a metalsmith.
Well, that's exactly what we want to know. And I always like to tee it up, your origin story and how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us all about Amy.
So I've lived in Chicago for probably over 25 years. But my beginnings were when I grew up in South Bend, Indiana, where For the Love of the Art Fair show is. I grew up in South Bend, Indiana, and I grew up in a family of four kids and my parents. And one of the things that we always did every summer is I was in 4-H. So all summer we would be signed up for classes. I would sign up for leatherworking. I signed up for woodworking. My mother was a sewing teacher. We showed animals. So there was always a creative environment in my house. And my mom sewed. My sisters were the sewers. I was the tomboy that went down to the basement and hung out with dad and made, you know, birdhouses. And I was in campfire. So, you know, there was always creativity happening in my house. And in high school, I didn't take as too many art classes. I mean, I took the general art classes. But then, you know, I went to college, and I went to college to study architecture. And I kind of struggled in architecture. I couldn't understand spatial stuff. And I was like, I wanted to be artistic, but it didn't work for me. So one semester, I was at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. I took a metalsmithing class. And it was this light bulb went off. It was just like, oh, here it is. Here's where I want to be. And then it just reminded me that, like, oh, my dad was a tool and die maker. Yeah, I would hang out in machine shops growing up. And my uncles all had machine shops. And there was always parties at the machine shops and family parties. And it was just like this epiphany for myself of, like, this is it. And so I dumped architecture, and I put my head in full to being to learning all metalsmithing. And then the other kind of fun thing about, like, that I realized at that time moment is, like, oh, of course I'm a metalsmith, because I grew up on Jewel Avenue in South Bend, Indiana. And my neighborhood was called Jewel Woods. And it was just like, oh, well, there it is. I grew up on the street that, you know, I became. So I got an undergraduate degree in metalsmithing and jewelry design at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. And then I took a year to, I think I had a job and I was just kind of hanging out in Milwaukee. And I, you know, took a year to kind of decide whether or not I wanted to go to graduate school. And so I did choose to go to graduate school, and I was either going to go out to New York, or I was going to go to Kansas, or I got accepted at the School of the Art Institute here in Chicago. And I chose the Art Institute, and I chose it because I wanted to take myself out of what I already knew and put myself into an environment I didn't know, which was fabulous because it was this access to teachers I've never, in medias I've never met. It was the beginning of the internet. So it was like, that was exciting. And I also just got to study with people that I've never imagined I would study with if I just went to a traditional program. So I graduated from grad school there. And what was interesting is my undergrad, I did a lot of small sculptures, but in graduate school, I sort of veered towards more adornments. And my MFA show was 6 jewelry vending machines that I installed for my thesis. And then I installed in the city of Chicago. So I did that for a little bit. And after graduate school, I got a job working for another jeweler. And that opened up my world to gemstones and production work and how to produce something handmade versus something that might be wax carved and produced and molded and things like that. And I was around all these gemstones, and it was a really extremely fabulous experience to have worked for, her name was Eve Alfier in Evanston. And she was such a prolific jewelry designer. And at the same time, I was starting my business. And so she was also a mentor in that way. She mentored me in my business. And she also gave me a small loan to start my studio. And I paid her back.
Oh, wow.
So it's just really, I've had a very generous, you know, experience with them and with working for Eve. And then during that time, I discovered that, I've always loved working with found objects, but, you know, being around gemstones, I was always like, wow, this is expensive. And so one day I was wandering through a antique store, and I found chandelier crystals. And I'm like, wow, they look like gemstones.
Enormous diamonds.
Yeah, enormous diamonds, but cheaper. And so I started playing with them. I'm actually wearing a couple of my pieces. And so I started playing with them. And so it's been, you know, over the last 20 years, I've developed this style of working with this one found object, which is chandelier crystals. Out of that, working for Eve, and then I started my business, and then along came teaching. I had an opportunity to teach jewelry classes. I started off at the Dominican University here out on the west side of the city. And then I actually ended up going back to University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee and teaching for 2 years. And so I fell in love with teaching. You know, not only was I in love with my job and my profession, but I fell in love with teaching. And I really love the idea of helping other people find their creative voice and helping these young students learn the art of metalsmithing and to create something with their hands. And ever since then, I've been teaching and I've settled at a place right now. I'm teaching at the Arts Center of Highland Park up in Highland Park, Illinois. I've been there for 19 years. I'm chair of the department. And so I help run the department as well as I teach 4 to 7 classes a week there. I teach wax carving and I teach metalsmithing and I teach workshops and specialty classes. And I'm just in love with all my students and teaching and seeing their happy faces when they create something all by themselves with my guidance.
What a completely joyful story. Completely charmed. So lovely.
Thank you.
How would you describe your artwork? We can't, unfortunately, on radio, and of course people can go to your website to see some of that, but maybe just describe some of the things that you create.
Well, I have several lines of jewelry that I create. The one I mentioned was from the chandelier crystals, where I treat them like a gemstone, and I'm always on the hunt for like most unusual chandelier crystals. And trust me, there are lots of chandelier crystals out there. And then I have a whole woven series where I hand weave rings and bracelets. So they're all out of sterling silver, hand woven. And then I have a crown ring series where they're all handmade crown rings with gemstones going around the tops of them. Some do, some don't. There's different gold and silver combinations. So I love hand making things. I also have another line of jewelry called the forget-me-nots. And a lot of times the forget-me-nots are composed of vintage chains, composed of vintage elements. There's always a chandelier crystal to them. And people bring me mom and dad's old items and we add those into those necklaces. And those become their own handmade created heirlooms that I create for them, custom pieces. There's the autograph pieces, which I growing up, I was always a collager. So, my mom collaged. And so I loved collaging, doing decoupage and stuff like that. So I do a lot of collaging, and over the last 30 years, I've collected, vintage recipe books and, shorthand books. And most my love is old autograph books because I love reading them because there's such a time jump and you get to read things. You're like, wow, that's how they said that. Or so I use those and I collage those and I have a thing called the autograph series. So those are kind of like my 4 to 5 collections that I produce.
And I'm looking at your website, which is ladysmithjewelry.com, and you can see a whole series of things there, and we'll remind our audience after that. Yeah, I see all your different collections. I even have one called the Chandelier Collection. I saw that. So
yeah, that's the chandelier pieces. So great thing about the chandelier pieces, it's always changing. The collection is like limited editions and one of a kinds because I'm always finding new shapes, new colors, new styles that I'm working with. And I like that. I like that that when you buy a piece of Ladysmith jewelry, you are getting a unique limited edition piece of jewelry.
And this goes to necklaces, rings, earrings, and bracelets, and that's your whole line, correct?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So where's your studio?
I live in Lincoln Square in Chicago, and it's a private studio, as you can see from behind me. You know, it's just the studio that's actually in the building I live in, and I've been so fortunate to find this little gem of a studio so I can come downstairs and, you know, get to work whenever I want.
I mean, it looks from what I can see just what I can see right now, looks like, oh no, okay, now it changed. That little bit I saw, it looked like it was staged for retail as well, but I can see now that it's not. It studio.
It's a working studio. It's a complete working studio. So it's just, that's just fodder behind me.
So do you cast as well, or is it just fabrication?
So I teach wax carving and casting at the Art Center in Highland Park. And I have a beginning and advanced class. And so we do it up there. The studio is not large enough for that. But, you know, one of the things about teaching is like I get the bonus of being able to make things in castings. It's not my favorite process. I'm a fabricator. I love having like the inspiration from an object and then running with it and fabricating around it. But, you know, wax carving is not my strength, but I enjoy teaching it. And my students take off from there. Like I have students that surpass me, which is awesome because that's the purpose of teaching.
I mean, that is, yeah, it is. And actually you chose such wonderful cities to be inspired in as well. I mean, Milwaukee is just amazing for its arts. Yes.
I've actually thought about moving back to Milwaukee because it's such a great art community. And I have friends live up there.
You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and on WVLP, 103.1 FM.
Yeah.
And then the Art Institute, what's not to be inspired, just walking through, you know. So when you went to the school, it was in the building of the Art Institute, right?
I jumped myself from a metalsmithing department to a sculpture department. Mm-hmm. So the sculpture studios were behind the Art Institute on Columbus Avenue. So that was the main building. But I even did an internship in the museum for a couple summers there. I did a conservation internship because I was interested in that. So I got to go to the basement of the basement of the basement of the Art Institute to see their collections, which was pretty cool, you know, go see a 13th century anvil and 13th century forging tools, which was really was an awesome experience as well.
I had the same type of experience, but at the Field Museum. It is like just amazing to go into the inner workings of a facility like that.
Yeah. And Chicago, you know, I never imagined I would end up staying in Chicago, but it's such a fabulous city. It has, you know, great opportunities for artists to do art fairs. I do art fairs during the summer. I take, I usually teach on Saturdays, but I take the summers off where I can do also art fairs. So I do the, local art fairs. I do a couple art fairs up in Milwaukee, and like the Love for the Love of Art Fair, which is I'm doing in March. And the largest gift show in Chicago is called the One of a Kind Show. And that is always the first weekend in December. And they also have a spring show, which was coming up in April, the spring One of a Kind Show it's the last weekend of April. So I do that. Like,
how many years have you been doing One of a Kind?
14.
Yeah.
14 years. Yep. It's a fabulous show. And I going to shows is a really great way for me to get myself out there and meet customers who I get to make custom work for. They see what I do and they're like, oh, I like this. And then they come to my studio and we make custom work for them as well. So that's what I love doing art fairs. It's not my full-time gig, but it's a different level of connection that I get to get with my customers. And I've met a lot of longtime customers doing shows who have become collectors of my work.
And do you go wide in your art fairs, like all over the country, or is it mostly in the Midwest?
No, I say Midwest. You know, I do the For Love. That's the one, the For Love Art Fair that Shireen Johnson does. I do one in Milwaukee. I do a couple in Milwaukee, and that's about it. That's about as far as I travel, because I do have a teaching job. I teach during the week, and I also teach, you know, teen summer camp. So that comes up too during the summer. You know, I have a week of teaching summer camp.
What do you? Is that in jewelry or is that other?
Yep, I love teens. Teens are awesome. They're challenging, but if I can give them a creative voice and inspire them to continue. Maybe in college they'll take a metals class, or in high school they'll take a metals class, and they'll I have actually teens in my adult classes, and that's, you know, I love having them, you know, because they, if they are interested in art, I want to keep them interested in art and give them an experience that's going to inspire them to be interested in art, whether or not they continue to take my class. Maybe they'll go take ceramics or painting or drawing. Yeah.
You touched on this a little bit, but where do you get some of your found objects? You just spot them. Like, I know in photography, sometimes I don't go out with a specific shooting mission and then shoot things. So I don't know. Where do you find your objects that are your found objects that you put in?
Well, Larry, I've been collecting for years. Okay. You know, even long before I started making jewelry, I've been collecting things for years because I have I love vintage things. Like, you know, my apartment's decorated mid-century modern, but I've been collecting that kind of stuff for so long that I have good stuff. And I just been, you know, garage sales, flea markets, online, you know, before online, it was always flea markets and garage sales. I was lucky enough to be able to access, I've been lucky enough to access people's personal collections. You know, I had a woman one time, there was an article in the Chicago Tribune about me years ago. And she saw that I made jewelry out of chandeliers, and she wrote me a letter and said, come to my house, and I have a chandelier for you. Well, she gave me this beautiful mid-century modern chandelier, these beautiful old vintage crystals. I made her a necklace and a bracelet and sent it to her after she gave them to me. So, you know, it's just connections. People connect me. They're like, oh, you like chandelier crystals? I have these. And so people give me things as well. And, you know, there's eBay, there's Etsy, you know. So I'm always on the out looking for new materials.
Yeah, that sounds great. And something we haven't touched on, but we have with some of our guests, is how did COVID impact you? Did it make a creative period for you? You probably couldn't teach remote, but maybe so tell us about how that did in coming out of it.
You could focus on your own personal work.
So the first thing I did is I actually cleaned my studio entirely and rearranged my studio. I did. I actually, because teaching 5 to 7 classes a week takes me away from my studio. So it was like focus. I just focused on my studio practice. I just started making work. And it was really lovely to just make work without, you know, having to have it go someplace. I could just make work. So I always say that in jewelry making, we're always making parts, and those parts will end up being something or scrap. I just, you know, put my head down and worked and enjoyed having uninterrupted devoted studio time. I was not down for very long because the Art Center in Highland Park went back to classes in July, and we just with safety measures. So that was nice too, to be connected back to that community. But it was good to have, like, you know, 4 months of just working, and shows were canceled, and that was okay, because, like, you know, that's how it went. And I got a lot of work done, and it was nice. And I adopted a dog like everybody else.
What do you like to do outside of jewelry making?
I like to work out and do triathlons and hang out with my friends. You know, I have standing time with friends, like standing dates that we try to get together, and spend times with my friends and my children and my family. And I'm also an awesome cook.
Oh, very good. What do you like to cook?
I'm mostly vegetarian foods. Okay. Give me a cookbook. I'll find a recipe.
And we touched on that, and Shireen Johnson was the one who put us in touch with you, because this show will be two artists, yourself and the one we had previously. But tell us about the Love of the Art Fair. That's going to be March 4th and 5th. And you've been there how many?
This is my third year? For Love of Art Fair. And I love it because it's a hometown show. And people that don't have the opportunity to come to Chicago, like at the One of a Kind show to see me, my friends at home, they come see me at that show. So it's a lot of laughter in my booth, as well as like a few sales here and there. And it's one of the joyous shows that I've been in for that reason. And I stay with my sister. I get to see my sister, and it's just a lovely show that's well attended. And I get to, like I said, have reunions in front of my booth. There's a lot of like, oh my God, I haven't seen you for so long. and I say, here's my collections. Here's what I do. And like, oh wow, that's so amazing. So it's really one of the things I love about it. It's like, it's this great hometown reunion for me. And it feels very proud to come back to South Bend.
Is there a jewelry, you know, they're like your children. Is there a piece that you just never can part with that you say, I've created this and this is not going?
A lot of my firsts. A lot of my firsts used to go to my mom, but a lot of my firsts I keep. And, you know, sometimes I make a piece, like I just finished a piece yesterday. I'm like, I'm sending that to my friend. You know, I'm going to send this off to a really wonderful friend of mine. So, yeah.
Well, we're just about ready to wrap up, Amy. So tell us about how people can find you online, Facebook, social media, and tell us once again about the South Bend Art Fair.
So you can find me in Chicago shows. In fact, next month I'm going to be at a show called the Chicago Artisan Market, which is February 11th and 12th. You can find me at ladysmithjewelry.com, and you can email me through Ladysmith Jewelry as well. If you have a custom piece that you were thinking about creating, you can find me Lady Smith Jewelry on Facebook and Lady Smith Art Girl on Instagram.
Love those art girls.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air. Again, that's Amy Butts. She's going to be at the South Bend Century for the Love of Art Fair. Sheree Johnson, who we've had on the show several times, on March 4th and 5th. Thank you so much for coming on Art on the Air.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Yeah,
many thanks.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org, and every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Radio, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art in the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. We'd like to thank our current underwriters for Art in the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, Macaulay Real Estate in Valparaiso, Olga Patrician, Senior Broker, and for WVLP, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art on the Air. We rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts. Give till it feels good, and you'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.